A lake is a river curled in a sleep like a snake. Thomas Lovell Beddoes. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate you. I know I took a week off, even though I didn't think I would, but just with the new year and Christmas and all that stuff, I was just a little bit lazy, so apologies for that. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you enjoy, and I hope you'll take advantage of the backlog of episodes. And to all returning listeners, you guys know how much I appreciate you. At least I hope you do. And I would like to go ahead and shout out YouTube. We're almost up to 200 subscribers. I hope by the time the episode's out, or at some point tomorrow or Monday, or whenever you're listening to this, we'll have reached 200. But with that out of the way, I do hope everyone had a happy new year and all that stuff. And I hope you're off to a very good 2025. Now, this week, we will kind of be finishing up our section covering Western Iran by talking about the Dalma culture. And we're going to start probably slash finish a Central Asian culture that we touched on a couple of seasons ago, as well as last season too. But this is the Jeitun culture, and this is, of course covers the period during the period of, why can't I talk? You can tell I've taken a week off. This is going to cover the time period of 6 to 4,000 BC, BCE, whichever you prefer. Before that, though, I did have someone ask a question about boule, which those are the larger clay balls that I talked about a couple of weeks ago. And someone asked why they used both the boule in addition to the clay tokens. And it's a very obvious question. I had it when I first read about them. And I feel dumb for not expanding on it and answering that question. But the boule tended to house several tokens that we talked about, the little smaller ones with the indentations. Of course, dried clay, we've talked about this before. It's useful for record keeping, but if you drop it, it can break or cause damage, especially to the symbols that might be impressed on it. And this is especially true for the smaller tokens. So what they would do is they use these larger, thicker balls to kind of store handfuls of the tokens as they were sturdier, and they would protect the smaller balls inside. Now, at later periods, the boule were stamped with official seals and devices to show that all the tokens inside were legitimate, not forgeries, which, if you think about it, was probably easy to do with the smaller tokens, because a lot of them, at least at the earlier periods, were hand designed. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of kind of uniformity to all of them. I mean, they had the same general indentation to mean the same thing, but, you know, individuals, you know, it's not machine made, so there's going to be differences between individuals making their own. But that would be true of people officially designated making them, and people, you know, making their own to pass off for extra rations or things like that. So that, you know, that always makes me think, you know, what are the events that led to the practice evolving? Who was the first person to commit fraud with the tokens? And how much they managed to get away with? Was it just food? Did they do it for beer? Did they do it for some type of processed good or tools? Who knows? Anyway, the boule, you know, would be handed over to officials in charge of, you know, the goods or whatever, and they would break them open, they would count, and then distribute the value of the tokens to the bearers. You have to remember that, you know, surplus grain needs to be stored, and since everyone, you know, was collecting it communally, they would store it communally. But not everyone would need to withdraw or use the same amount of grain at the same time. So, you know, you're a father of four, you may need all of your grain when it's available. Whereas if you're just a single individual, you may not need to draw out all the grain that you're entitled to at one time. And of course, this system continues to coexist with writing in many places for centuries after that. So it's just kind of a backup to the written record keeping. Now, we're going to go ahead and move along to the primary focus of this week's episode, and that is the Dalma culture. Now, the name comes from the type site where evidence of this material culture was first discovered. This is Dalma Tepe. And the name comes from the modern village of Dalma, which is near the southwestern shore of Lake Urmia. And I think I mentioned this when we were talking about etymology, but this is like the largest lake in Iran. That's like the sixth largest saltwater lake in the world. Now, I tried to find an etymological breakdown of Dalma, but I couldn't find like a definitive answer. There's a couple of options. There's a very simple Arabic translation, which there is an Arabic word for. It is just Dalma or Zalma, depending, I guess, on your dialect of Arabic. But of course, the primary languages of Persia or... Sorry, it was Persia when the site was first excavated. It's Iran now. But of course, Arabic is not the primary language spoken in Persia or Iran. So that doesn't really make too much of sense. But in Arabic, Dalma means darkness. So it could mean something like the dark hill. But the other option, and the one I think is probably far more likely, is that it could be related to a Turkish word like dalmak, which is like to fall or collapse, usually in relation to sleep, like you just fell asleep or collapsed in exhaustion to sleep. Now, the region that Dalma Tepe is fairly diverse. There are Armenians, Assyrians, Kurds, I think even some Sephardic Jews, as well as Azerbaijani, and other ethnic groups as well live in the region. And while, you know, I couldn't find any firm numbers, it looks like the Azerbaijani are the largest ethnic group in the area, and the Azerbaijani speak Azeri, which is a variety of Turkic, so it could have come from that. So it could be something like the Sleeping Hill or the Fallen Hill or something like that. Now, Dalma and another initial site, Hasanlu Tepe, were first excavated in 1961. Now, since then, I think around a dozen or so sites have been identified. Some as far south as the northern Zagros Mountains, though these appear to be a little bit later. The new excavations have taken place at the initial couple of sites as recently as 2021, so there was like a 60-year gap in between excavations. But it is nice to see that they are starting to reinvestigate their area with newer, more advanced techniques, technology, all that kind of stuff. Now, the sites, again, around Lake Urmia are the earliest, and they were first founded around 5000 BC. Now, this culture is firmly within the Pottery and Neolithic from the very outset. As soon as the site is founded, they're making pottery. And it's simple at first, but it is well made. It's usually, the older pottery pieces are usually a very light brown color. No decorations, no different layers of color. But later they do begin to paint, simple geometric patterns and lines on them. And kind of the base color becomes a darker brown. Or maybe like a darker red, depending on, you know, obviously they've been underground in a while, so it's kind of hard to say the exact color, but it's something along those lines. They also, at some parts, or some places, did begin impressing them with cords of rope or string or things like that, you know, just so you'd have something to kind of help you tie pots together or use the ropes for handling. And the pottery is really the defining aspect of this society, and that's like most of what you'll see talked about with this culture, because a lot of their tools and things like that, stone, bone, obsidian, all of that's not too dissimilar from other cultures. Again, some of this stuff we're talking about, there's not a huge difference, especially with all these neighboring cultures. So you just have to pick out what is different in a lot of these cases. The reason that the Dalma culture is so, you know, I guess talked about in addition to that pottery is because the pottery is spread out over a wide area, or at least a relatively wide area based on their number of sites. And this is because of the kind of the second big aspect of this culture, and it ties into a point I brought up a couple of episodes ago. The Dalma culture was split into larger, permanent, sedentary villages and smaller temporary or seasonal sites near kind of prime grazing and gathering areas, with parts of their population apparently moving between the temporary sites with herds of animals, where they would, you know, occasionally stop off at the permanent settlements. It's kind of easy to imagine and theorize that maybe the more active, mature youths joined with, you know, the healthier, active adults to kind of manage and guard their herds while moving them between their villages and various grazing lands. And of course, the villages were occupied by maybe the very young, the pregnant women, the very old, the sick, or people who were just very talented crafters, you know, every so often. They'd probably do things like trading materials from one region they had been to back to another, and then, you know, trading those materials for processed tools and equipment like pottery, or, you know, maybe spun or woven clothes, things like that. Of course, they'd also swap crops and animals, you know, probably animals to the sedentary villages to kind of give them a nice shot of protein, and, you know, the flour and things like that from wheat to bake when you're on the road, things like that. Of course, there'd also be a good opportunity to establish or renew familial ties between the various settlements. I can imagine, you know, a guy going, "Hey, you're coming with me this season. We've got to take you to your great uncle Bob's village. He's got a niece you've got to marry. And I know cousin marriage, you know, for the majority of human history, most humans have married within the fourth degree relation of some kind. So it's not that unusual, especially when you're not traveling vast distances. Now that's obviously something that's changed very recently, but in the past it's still very common and will be for quite some time. But anyway, this mix in lifestyles led to the Dalma being spread over about 15,000 square kilometers, which is like 15,000 square miles, which is like 40,000 square kilometers. And there is also evidence that their mobile contingents had contacts with neighboring groups that we've talked about this season, like those in the Caucasus, northern Mesopotamia, the Caspian coast, the Susian sites as well. And, you know, this is probably one of the things that they're bringing back to their own villages. That's very, very likely. Now, their burial practices are only known at the sedentary sites. there is no evidence of grade goods or social stratification from the burials. In fact, I don't think they found adults or, you know, kids even really buried in the sites themselves. I think the expectation is that they were probably buried on the outskirts of their villages. Maybe even possibly they were cremated. We don't really know. However, we have found infants interred underneath their homes, which isn't something that's unheard of. This does happen in other places. It has happened in other places, as we've talked about. But it appears as if at least the infants are the only people being buried within the bounds of the settlements themselves. Now, their homes were very simple. They were made of layers of packed mud. Not mud brick, just packed mud. And they didn't seem to have a single type of floor plan or anything like that. They could vary in size and kind of general shape. Obviously, they were typically typically square, though some were, of course, a little bit more rounded. Maybe not perfect squares. But you imagine having to deal with a packed clay and mud. It's probably not the easiest thing to shape if you're not making bricks. Now, I will say, though, some of their buildings were, of course, larger than others. Some of them did have fairly high walls, reaching almost 5 feet. And then some, you know, the dwellings weren't more than 5 feet tall. So fairly short people. Also, some of the homes just had open floor plans. There was no, like, separated area. There were no interior walls, but some did have those. So there's, you know, kind of a lot of variation in the settlements and in the homes themselves. The settlements, or at least some of them, did show evidence of small-scale fortifications and defenses, things like ditches, evidence of like smaller, maybe wooden palisade type walls, or maybe like a mix of clay and or mud and logs and things like that. Now, unfortunately, the dating on these people is kind of hard to nail down, especially at the later points, because we don't have a lot of other artifacts to kind of compare. You know, sometimes you can tell, okay, well, they have pottery from this period who we can absolutely date, especially, like I said again, dating in the Mesopotamian region is a lot easier because everything is very clearly layered because of, like, you know, the floods and all that kind of stuff. We can kind of guess fairly easily when certain things are done in those regions. Other regions don't have that, so it's kind of a context clues-based situation. So the end of the Dalma period isn't quite as well known. It's a little bit debated. But generally, they are thought to have maintained this kind of lifestyle slash cultural cohesion until around sometime between 4200 and 4000 BC. After that, something causes a breakdown in the connection between the various sites. Maybe the areas couldn't support the pastoralist population anymore, and they left for greener pastures. Sorry about that pun. That was not planned. But there also could have been the increasing demand for copper could have led to a portion of their populations moving in search of areas with the metal, or disrupted their traditional trade and economy, or maybe outsiders came in and began, you know, moving to areas where they could find copper, and that disrupted their connections. Sadly, we don't really know. There doesn't appear to be any, like, massive layers of destruction like there were at the Susian sites. But there is the fact that not all of their sites are abandoned, though. Hasanlutepe is going to be continually occupied, at least at some levels, maybe not quite as highly populated as as the Dalma period, though at some points it would be more populated, but it's occupied until the 3rd century AD. And of course it falls under various other cultural influences during all that time. So that is a little bit of a mystery. Were they perhaps affected by the collapse of the Susian, or not necessarily the collapse of the Susian, because the Susian doesn't collapse, but remember, the Susian do move further kind of south and east. Maybe that lack of trade and connection with those peoples there disrupted the economy enough to cause the collapse of the Dalma. This is all speculation, of course. I'm not sadly too sure. Again, some of the archaeological stuff, especially with the Susian, has sadly been lost to time or just hasn't been fully studied due to various factors, including the Iranian Revolution, the Iran-Iraq War, all that kind of stuff. But now, we're going to go ahead and be moving on to the Jetun culture. Now, we talked about this culture last season, and I brought them up when talking about their probable and possible connections to the peoples of the southern Caspian Sea coast. And this is the first known culture of Central Asia to practice agriculture and herding. Well, agriculture, definitely. Not necessarily herding, but in conjunction, yes. Of course, that's provided that you don't consider Iran part of Central Asia, or I guess Northwest India either. Generally speaking, I think I'm just referring to the Stan cultures these days when you speak of Central Asia. This site was found 19 miles, which is like 29-30 kilometers north of the modern city of Ashgabat. And this is the capital of Turkmenistan. And the site was originally occupied, possibly as early as 7500 BC. And it has been more or less, or had been more or less, continually occupied until kind of the start of this season. Now, this culture hadn't changed much since the last time we checked in on them. It does appear to have expanded with some other sites growing almost exactly the same crops, tending almost to the exact same animals, having almost identical tools, that kind of thing. And I think the number of sites, you know, I didn't find an exact number, but there's more than five that have popped up in the 1500 years since Jetun was founded. And that's just on this side of the Kopet Dag mountain range, which is the north side. That's kind of the foothills where Ashgabat is. It's just to the north of that mountain range. Anyway, their sites spread to the north and the west, reaching the southeast of the Caspian Sea and the Gorgon Plain we talked about a couple of episodes ago. And remember, there is the theory that the people there may have been migrants from the Jetun culture. They definitely had trade links, regardless if they were related or not. There is also another theory that some Jetun people moved south through the mountains and spread agriculture and herding as they went, where they mixed with other peoples who had moved in from Mesopotamia, at various waves since the founding of the Jetun. This may have been something that continued over time. It's possible that those, moving south are the ones that moved into the Susian area, and they may have been a cause of the destruction that caused the collapse of some of the early Susian sites. There's, also speculation that there were contacts between Jetun and the Marigar settlements in the Indian subcontinent, who we will return to in an episode or two. And remember, because these two sites were founded fairly early in the Neolithic. So it wouldn't surprise me at all that there would be contacts. Now, this is of course just speculation, brought about me just because of time frame and just the nature of humanity and how we've seen other groups do travel. Now, it wouldn't be an easy journey, but it'd certainly be possible. Other people make the connection because there are similarities in a couple of different types of artifacts. Not all of them, but a few of them. So I wouldn't be surprised if one day we found a whole cache of items, from Marigar in this region, at one of the various Jotun sites or the sites associated with the Jotun culture. But yeah, so Jotun is kind of carried on as it always has during this, very long period. However, there is one big change that's kind of going on at the site itself, and that is the uniformity of the site. Early on, the homes are all, fairly similar, same size, but same general size, same layout, but they're very simple, mud huts, and then I think with some evidence of wood being used as well. However, these homes have become more advanced as time goes on. They keep the same layout. In fact, the homes are, very, very close in size and shape. They're all rectangular. They all have fireplaces on one of the sides. That's not uniform. That's probably something due with spacing. They also had little kind of almost yards, essentially, is what I'd probably refer to them as. They were probably used to house or store things. Maybe store some animals, maybe house some material for whatever. There are around 30 or so homes of this size at Jotun around, I think, as late as 5000 BC. Give or take a century or two. And the floors were covered with a lime plaster, so they have figured out how to make lime. And they were made with sun-dried clay blocks. They're cylindrical, actually, so that's fairly interesting. And the blocks are all around the same size. About 70 centimeters long and 20 centimeters thick. And the clay was all mixed with chopped straw. So you use that as kind of a strengthening material to keep the bricks shaped and together. And I think the estimated size of the population with that many homes is they could have had up to 200 on the high side. And if you just had smaller families, you'd probably be looking at 150. Now, I should note that I could not find any other sites or Jotun sites mentioned that they had this same kind of housing and floor plan. So it's possible that these sites were not organized and planned out in the same way. Now, why that is, I don't know. I can't say. However, my guess would be that it's possible that they just didn't have the population at the other sites to justify the work needed to establish their homes like that, much less maintain them, because you do have to remember that those bricks do eventually, begin to degrade. You do have to replace them from storms and things like that. So it's possible that they just didn't have enough access to the material at these other sites. This could have been something that just Jotun had that luxury for. Now, its population also remains fairly stable. It doesn't really expand. It does contract at periods, but it's never fully abandoned, at least until the very end. Well, about 500 years before this season ends. This is probably due to environmental changes. It doesn't look like there was as much water coming down. They have runoff from the mountains. Unfortunately, they also had to rely on, I think, rain to an extent, though this is kind of one of those environmental changes that's kind of guessed at. We're not 100% sure. It's also possible that they had over-farmed the soil over time. It's maybe that they were... Maybe that's the reason that we see all these sites. Maybe they had kind of realized, like, hey, we're only able to grow so much food here. We need to send people out to find their own homes because we just can't grow anymore here. Despite the fact that Jetun is abandoned, some of the sites that, you know, are associated with the Jetun culture are not. There's some of those continue for a number of years and centuries afterwards. Some will be abandoned at around the same time. Some continue on. But there are other sites that are being founded around the end of Jetun, around 4,500. Whether or not these were Jetun refugees or if these were new peoples coming down from the north in the Eurasian steppe or coming from the east in the Indian subcontinent or from the north, peoples coming from the Iranian plateau, this is debated. Sadly, I don't know of any DNA evidence that kind of gives an answer one way or the other. None of that would be definitive, of course, because it would be a very small population size to sample from, but unfortunately, it's entirely speculative. However, one of these sites that is founded around 4,500 is going to be very important next season, as it will be a major center of copper working in Central Asia. And it's kind of going to have a very large impact on a lot of metalwork in the region for quite a while. Whether people know that or not, in terms of like the people working the metal, but a lot of the techniques, the designs, they'll be influential in later people's works. And this is the site of Anau. And the Anau culture is going to be kind of the successor to the Jetun culture in the region. Though, obviously, it's not necessarily a direct continuation, and it's a little bit different from the Jetun in terms of impact and size, but it is important in the history of the region. And that's going to be one of the focuses on this area of the world again next season, because I don't think copper use gets here just yet. It is coming up from Persia, Iran, but it's not there just yet. But Anau is in a good spot to take advantage of this new technology, and they're able to kind of develop mastery of the metal. And that's going to have an impact for a number of places and peoples going forward. That's kind of what I have for this part of the world for this season. We're going to be moving on to some other Central Asian places. And, of course, we'll also be checking back in with Marigar and the Indian subcontinent. And then we'll be going to Southeast Asia after that. But there will be a few episodes, of course, before we get to Southeast Asia. Like I said, we're going to be talking about the Indian subcontinent, some other places in Central Asia. And then we'll be going from there. One big thing I did forget to mention about Anau. The domesticated pig, I forget the name, the scientific name, and I'll remember to look this up, but it shows up at Anau as soon as it is founded. Now, the pig is domesticated in Southeast Asia initially, so it spreads very quickly through, you know, kind of the northern part of the Indian subcontinent. And the fact that, you know, there's no evidence of pre-domesticated versions of the pig prior to this period means that Anau is maybe founded by people who bring pigs to the region, or at the very least, they know people who have pigs and they get pigs from them, and these are fully domesticated versions of the animal. This is evidence of pig domestication in this region, and it's, you know, I'm very possible that the pig will spread out from this area to the places further west in the Iranian plateau in the Middle East. At least that's one area it could come from. But that's stuff we'll talk about, of course, in the future as well. So I think that's what I have for you guys this week. Thank you all for joining me. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. If you guys have any questions or comments or constructive criticism, please feel free to let me know. I will be back next week with our regularly scheduled episode. We're going to be back to normal for the foreseeable future. I hope you guys have missed me as much as I've missed doing the show, or at least half as much. Please like, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff. You can, again, contact me at war@revpod@gmail.com. You can direct message me on X/Twitter. You can go by the YouTube channel, comment on the videos there. I do respond to comments fairly regularly. So, of course, if you comment on a newer video, I'm more likely to see it sooner. But you're welcome to comment on the old stuff, too. I'm also streaming regularly on YouTube. That's where I've picked up a number of subscribers the last couple of weeks. You're welcome to drop in, say hi there. You can't post links or sources or anything like that in YouTube. YouTube does not allow you to do that. But you can at least, you know, say, hey, you should check this out, and I can look at it there. Thank you all for joining me again, and I hope you have a good rest of your day/week from whenever you're listening to this. You all please take care, and I'll see you all next time. Peace.